to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our third series. And this is our series on Vietnam. They call it Vietnam, the 52-year war, because even though the war was over officially, April 30th, 1975, actually my birthday is April 30th, it really wasn't over for everybody. It wasn't like when the war was over, it wasn't just pushing helicopters off of aircraft carriers. You know, we see those iconic pictures. But what it really was, it was a war that affected people to this date. We're talking people in this country. We're talking people in Vietnam. And so what we really want to do in this series is to talk to some of the vets that were there. This is not a political discussion. What it is a discussion of how maybe war in general, or particularly the Vietnam War, affects people. And these are things we need to consider. I really want to do a special thank you to Christopher Gaynor, who called me and helped me arrange interviews with people. He overloaded my hard drive with his emails. Uh-huh. And
that's me.
So also, I think, you know, this is not my story. It is a story of these men and women mm-hmm. that we'll be interviewing that spent time there and know exactly what happened. And from me doing this, I have really learned a lot. And I need to say it's also given me a much greater respect for the sacrifices these men made and these women made. And so that's what we're here to talk about, to talk about human emotions, to talk about feelings. And let's go from there. So our first interview today is going to be with Gary Burka. And Gary lives in Spanaway, right?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh.
Spanaway. And he and I have talked many times on the phone. Gary has written a book with Chris's assistance called Ambush. And I just got into it last night. Chris brought it over. And pretty poignant and pretty scary from my perspective. I did not spend time in Vietnam, but many of my friends and fellow graduates in 1966 did. So let's start out with Gary. Gary, tell me kind of about your life a little bit, you know, maybe a couple years, you know, before you went to Vietnam, because I think one of the things that strikes me most about Vietnam is that it was the men and women that went over there were just average Joes. I mean, they, you know, they came out of the farms, they came out of the factories, they came out of every place. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I was just a young kid, 18 years old at the time, when I was drafted. And I had just gotten, you know, through school and got a job with Patelco, a company that I retired from, actually. I think I'd been working there for 2 or 3 weeks. But prior to that, I was just a country boy. I lived out in Graham. And I loved to hunt and fish and do all those things.
Sure,
like that.
Sure.
And then I got drafted and went to Vietnam. And
Did you do your basic training at Fort Lewis?
Yes, I did. I did both my AIT and my basic training both there.
Okay.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, and one of the things that has seemed fairly consistent is, you know, you were taken out of the world of Graham, which is, you know, pretty much a Norman Rockwell picture, and put in a little different setting. What were your first impressions when you landed in Vietnam?
Well, on a trip on over, it was a 17-hour flight. I remember landing in Japan on the way and refueling, and then I saw Mount Fuji, and it was one of the most beautiful mountains on the way over. And then we continued to fly, and we landed in Vietnam and in Cam Ranh Bay, and I remember getting off the plane and how humid and hot it was, and coming from straight from Washington State, not having the humidity or the heat.
Or the rain.
Probably. Or the, yeah.
Well, during different times of the year.
Yeah, we had monsoons over there, but it was like 70 degrees or warmer.
And, right. You know, and, I've been in New Orleans at different, we've exactly. been in New Orleans when the sun was shining and they said, uh-oh, we see a dark cloud and, you know, get undercover. And that was kind of the way it was. Were there a lot of, other folks in the same situation as you? They were coming over on the plane, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And were they all kind of talking about what's this all going to be about? Were they hyped? Were they nervous? Were they quiet?
Yeah, I think everybody at that point was pretty quiet. And I think preoccupied, you know, thinking about things like myself. I questioned or wondered, you know, is this place a swamp or is it jungle or just what is it, you know? And
yeah.
And so as we landed, then they took us up to Chu Lai at that point. And that was, my entry point was Cam Ranh Bay. And then we went to Chu Lai from there.
And you talked in there about a triple canopy. Is that, tell us what that is.
Well, it's a very, very thick jungle, and it's very difficult to make it through it. You know, that's why they produced the Agent Orange to eliminate a lot of that.
Okay.
Prior to us coming through it.
You know? Uh-huh. So you landed, they send you out to Chu Lai. At that point, do you go through and they give you a rifle and a gun and
well,
tell you which way to point it? And
Our first is, if I remember right, the first thing that they did with us is I came into Chu Lai and they assigned us various jobs, and kept us there for like 2 weeks at a time to acclimate to the heat, which was tremendous. So my first job was burning human waste, and then they gave me another job, which was working in the mess hall, KP, doing KP, and it was extremely hot in the mess hall.
You know, it's interesting. Most of the pictures that I've seen, you know, from my friends and, you know, other people that have sent them, very few people wearing shirts.
Right.
I'm sure all of us wouldn't look as good now if we weren't wearing shirts, now, you know, at the radio station here, but, you know, that's just
20-year-old.
Yeah, that's just what happens when when you get. But I think that was the one thing, was the humidity and tell me that story about the guy that the guy in the mess hall that was fixing the soup.
Oh gosh, there was a guy in the mess hall and we had this great, it was a huge bowl of soup, and he's stirring it with what looked like a small bodor, and he's stirring away, and as I focused in on him, I realized, gee, he's got a bead of sweat right on the end of his nose, and it's hanging right over the soup. and I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't think I'm going to eat tonight. You know,
yeah. But
I was so extremely hot that I couldn't eat, sleep, or do anything right. And it took, that's why we had to acclimate.
How long were you there before you, and you were in the infantry?
Yes.
And you said you were a machine gunner.
That's correct.
And did you carry, you carried this thing around with you? Did you, you know, you see the pictures of all the guys with the, you know, bullets over their shoulders. And
right. I had an ammo bearer, and then I carried the machine gun. But and then I carried a lot of water, and I carried a rucksack with a camera in it and stuff.
But, yeah.
Yeah, my rucksack, the amount of weight we carried was tremendous. And we, you know, so one thing I remember, I didn't think we'd hike, you know, when we were doing our basic training and stuff, we were on a 12-mile forced march, which we had to complete by a certain amount of time.
Right.
And I thought, oh, baloney, we're not gonna hump that far, you know. When I got over here, I was dead wrong on that one.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, too. You mentioned that. All the pictures that I've seen of the Americans, you know, out in the field, that it looks like, boy, that's a lot of, you know, especially in that heat. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of stuff to carry. Mm-hmm. I also heard the statement from my friend. It said that, you know, that you had to carry water, and you got water wherever you could. You know,
right.
You had your pills you could put in it to purify it.
Right.
But, and he said, a lot of times they'd put in just the purifier and Kool-Aid or something to, you know, take the taste out of it. Yeah.
Take the iodine away.
Uh-huh. And how long were you out before you actually wound up and found yourself in you know, in battle or in a firefight?
Well, actually, what we did is we acclimated in July, then went duck full, which was, I think, about 40 or 60 miles from Chulai. And
is that towards the Cambodian border?
Towards south, headed.
Okay.
South okay. And then from there we would transfer from there on out to San Juan Hill and then down to the field. But when we got down to the field, I remember being about 3 days in the field before they sent me out on a snakey, which was a little three-man reconnaissance type mission, and they would send us out of like 1,000 feet from the company, and then we'd call situation reports in.
So you were looking for a movement or signs that people had been there, and
exactly, and it would, we'd spend the night out there. We'd have a starlight scope, and we could view, you know, with this starlight scope, if everything was working right. Oftentimes they didn't work.
Sure.
And so anyway, we're out one night, and the next thing we know, we get a call, you know, from the company stating that they're getting a lot of movement, ground movement. They could
that they're
could
seeing in the starlight or something.
No, they could we put ground radar, you know, on the ground, and you could hear footsteps that way.
Ah, okay.
And so we or the company was hearing a lot of movement that way coming towards them, and so they called artillery in, and they'd fire these what they called a firecracker round, and this round would ignite in the air, blow up in the air, and
white
release
phosphorus or something like that.
It was like white phosphorus, only it contained a whole bunch of little grenades, and these grenades would come down and land on the ground and blow up, and they could herd the people into the company, and that's what they did. So anyway, that particular night, all of a sudden, it was probably midnight, and all of a sudden a trip flare went off, and the company just lit up, and we're just right to the ground, because there's rounds going over us and everything too. And so
I think you made the comment, or maybe it was Rick made the comment, you didn't know how much, you never realized how much of your body you could get inside that helmet.
Exactly. You're laying low as you can lay. And anyway, we're down like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, it was probably 20 minutes after the firing subsided. All of a sudden we hear, I chuhoy, chuhoy. And that meant I surrender. And, well, being late at night like that, and we knew that there was others out there, nobody was going to go, you know, get that person.
So it was almost like a decoy to...
Exactly. We were worried that that's what, what it was.
Yes. Yeah.
So anyway, at that point, we are laying there quiet and everything. We call a situation report in that we're all okay after all the firing subsided, and let the company know that everything's good. And pretty soon we start hearing a bunch of breathing, you know. And so we're quiet. I turn the radio off so that whatever we're hearing can't hear us. And,
yeah.
And our hearts are pounding, and, you know, we're pretty nervous at that point. Come about, you know, daybreak, pretty soon we quit hearing the I-chu-hoy. We quit hearing that. And then all of a sudden the breathing stops, and come daylight, the dawn is breaking and stuff, and we're still, you know, pretty rattled, pretty shook up.
You've got to be, I mean, if they're yelling Chuhoy, you've got to be pretty close to them. I mean.
Yeah, we were very close. And
but you couldn't see them. You just heard the.
No, it was too dark at that point.
So
then daybreak came about, and the breathing had quit. And so we looked out, and we realized it was a monkey that had been wounded over by us, and we could hear him breathing, and he finally bled out and died, and but he was wounded by all the firing and stuff. See?
Sure.
And then they went out later and on a patrol and gathered up the bodies of the Vietnamese that came in, or the one who had been wounded in the calf and bled out and died. But,
And that must have. I mean, that's kind of all almost, you know, there are some things in your life that you can learn about and you can deal with. Some things you can't. And the things that I'm thinking about are like, you know, nobody knows what it's like being married until you're married, you know.
Right.
Nobody knows what it's like having kids until you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it seems to me that that's kind of this type of situation, is that, you know, you can talk about war, you can see war movies, you can do everything, but, you know, but when you're there, that's something that you have nothing to compare it to. I mean, is that a fair statement? I mean,
yeah, I think so, Steve. I that particular day, I learned that, hey, I'm in a real thing here. This is real. And it's not playing cowboys and Indians or anything like this. This is the real thing.
Right. People are dying.
And it really gives you a sense of, I miss my home.
Yeah.
You know, you're young, you're 18 years old at the time, and you really realize how important family.
And it must kind of give you a feeling too, kind of your own mortality. I, you know, when you're young like that, I had a best friend when I was in high school that died in a motorcycle accident a week before he graduated. Mm-hmm. And before that, you're invulnerable.
Right.
You know, nothing's ever, you know, you can see statistics and you can look at Walter Cronkite and say that there were 3,000 enemy killed and 100 Americans died, and it was the body count, and it didn't mean anything to you, but you were there, and all of a sudden, you were in that list of wounded. All of a sudden, you were on that list.
Yeah.
Gary Burka was on that list.
Yeah.
And you were wounded, correctly?
Yes, that's correct. I got hit twice the same day. We were in an ambush, and it went on for quite some time. There were a lot of people that were wounded that day. And
you were wounded three times, weren't you?
No, I was wounded twice. Rick
got three.
He was wounded three times. Yeah.
And Rick, who we're going to interview, was in that firefight with you.
That's correct. Yes.
And we've got about 10 minutes here. Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll kind of open it up for the rest of the guys. And first of all, let me tell you, I know you were worried about me interviewing you, but you are great, Gary.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I think you've got a, I think you've got a second occupation as a DJ. You know, maybe in a bar someplace, moving one of those record things back and. But and just tell me a little bit about going back home. How were you treated? Was it something you wanted to talk about? Was it something that, you know?
I remember when I went back home. First off, I guess I shouldn't mention I had liquor inventory. The last 2 months of my job over there, they took me out of the field and asked me if I wanted to shine boots for the general or liquor inventory. And I thought, well, that was kind of a no-brainer. And so, even though I couldn't add right, I figured I'd take the inventory. So
you had control of the inventory of the liquor.
Yes.
And uh-huh.
So anyway, I have.
Sounds like a better job than, burning human waste.
So I moved up in the world.
Yeah.
So.
When you want spillage, the other you don't.
So I remember getting on the, you know, we hit Cameron Bay and, we're getting ready to take off, and we're all aboard this Pan Am jet, and we're all excited. And the captain comes across on the radio, "You guys ready?" And you could have heard everybody even at home, "Yay!"
Yeah.
You know, and it was exciting. I mean, we got to this point, and none of us really expected to make it back home. And
I would imagine after some of those. You know, you don't have to, it doesn't sound like you got to be through three firefights like that to realize, hey, you know, one more is not necessary.
Yeah, right. So we get going and all of a sudden we're going down the runway probably 80, 100 mile an hour. And all of a sudden he slams the brakes on and reverses his jet. And then he comes across, he says, "I can't get enough wind to get full RPM," and everybody's hearts are just pounding. You're thinking, "We're not going to make it." and so finally, he says, "Well, I'm going to take another direction on runway," and so he does, and off we go, and we get up in the air, and the next thing I remember, the stewardess asking, "Hey, does anybody want a drink?" And again, you could hear everybody.
Yes,
everybody clear to Washington, you know. So she comes around and she asked me, if I want a drink. I said, "You bet," you know. And she said, "Well, I got to see your ID." And
I never thought about that. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and I gave her my ID. She said, "I'm sorry, I can't serve you," you know, and. So anyway, what happened at that point, I asked her, could I get some Coke? And I just happened to have a bottle of 151 rum in my...
yes, 151.
Yeah, and I didn't realize, it made the trip a lot shorter back home, but I didn't realize how it would affect you 30,000 feet up. You
know? Yeah.
It really, really...
Yeah. Doesn't take much.
Yeah.
So anyway... We had that flight, and part of it I couldn't remember. When I got home, I remember people not being, you know, they were rude, and they would spit at you a lot of times or throw rocks at you.
Was that where you were in your uniform? Is that correct?
Yeah. At that point, yes. But you know, otherwise I was treated good at home after that without my uniform.
Right.
And stuff.
People that you knew in the community and stuff. Yeah.
Right.
I think that's kind of my friend that went back to Ellensburg, you know, once he, you know, left and was, you know, out of his uniform. People knew him, people cared for him, people knew that he was just a farm kid and, you know, and doing his job in the Army. And, Rick, is there anything you'd like to say? Have you been listening to this? And
yeah, I've been listening to it.
Any comments you'd like to make about, you know, working with Gary and being with him. And I know you care about him dearly, and he cares about you dearly. And I think you said he saved your life one time. So
yes, he did. You know, I was drafted. I was having a great life. You know, really didn't want any part of it. But when you get drafted, you go. And it was just that simple. I did my basic, my AIT at Fort Gordon, went over, went through Cameron Bay up to Chulai. And there, I really didn't have a job. What I had was classes and a lot of jungle training. And then out to Duck Pool I went, up to San Juan Hill, and then back out to the bush when we got choppered out of there. And, you know, worked the same place as Gary did, the Triple Canopy Jungles and that. And then at one point during it, we were told that we had to go work with First of the First Cav, which was basically it's a mech unit, you know, tanks, APCs, things like that. And we thought, okay, well, we got to go down to the flatlands now. And we got there. And, I mean, these guys got fires going, radios going, and they have a huge NDP, a night defensive position. And we're wondering, what the heck's going on here? Because where we worked, we were quiet. We worked all three fire zones up in the mountains. And it must have been about 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, each guy's pulling a guard duty at his hole there. And all of a sudden, they let loose with everything. Everything they had, 50 cals, 16s, 79s, whatever it was. And when it got done, I said to the one guy on the tank, I said, what the heck are you guys doing? He goes, it's a mad minute. Mm-hmm. They already know we're here. We're just going to let them know what they're going to get if they do come to get us.
Yeah.
And we worked with them from August 23rd to the 29th of 69, and we got hit every day, you know, firefights, mortars, everything like that. And the one day that Gary did save my life was August 29th. We walked into a horseshoe ambush. We took in a Chu Hoi, and we knew which we were on a search and destroy mission for an NVA underground hospital, and we knew which way we were kind of going to go because we scouted the area and did patrols and different things like that. And he was sending us a different way. Well, since we didn't have a whole lot to say in the matter, Army Intelligence did. We went the way that he told us to go, and we walked into a huge horseshoe ambush, which means you walk in, picture a horseshoe, and after you get inside this, then they close off the back, and the fight is on.
So the Chu Hoi kind of comes up the middle. You kind of move that way, and then they come in around you on the sides.
Well, no, the Chu Hoi had already been taken back. He told them, he told us which way to go, and the captain and that, they make the decisions, and S4 and all that, make the decisions. So picture a horseshoe, and you got a company of about 110 men, and they walk into this area, and we're spread out. I mean, we take a huge area to as we're going down through there. And at that point there, they close off the back end, and it was estimated to be at least a battalion, maybe more, and a battalion's 500 of NVA. And, you know, the fight's on, and it's basically around an eight-hour firefight. And we had four F-4s, which are jets, bombing so close they're literally bouncing off the ground. We had artillery from every base that was around there to support us. We had seven Cobra gunships working out to try to get us out of there. And we finally got out of it. And basically what happened to me during it is I rushed forward. And during the firefight, as we're eliminating the enemy, I got hit with a mortar. And I just feel rough. There's nothing you can do at this point. You just got to keep fighting and keep moving around. And that's what I did.
Hey, Rick,
I got hit. Yeah.
one thing I need to say right now, you know how they give you those teasers on the news thing at night? Well, we have run out of time for this thing. So now you're going to have to listen to Rick Adler in the next half hour. So you are my teaser for the next show. And let's finish this up because I think this is really important. And, you know, it's one of the things that I've noticed I don't know if Gary appreciates me for saying this, but as you're telling this story, I'm watching Gary, and I can just see Gary relive this thing. You know, almost like it's a photograph in his mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critical. Mm-hmm. So let's close her up for right now. We'll do the intro again the next time, and I'll bring you right back in. And thank you, Rick Adler, and thank you, Gary Burka. I do think you have a job in radio. And so thank you. I almost said thank you, Vietnam, but I meant thank you, Vashon. At least they both start with a V. So you take care and have a great day.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofvashon.org and look under the Shows tab.